Good morning. We have an unsurpassed, penetrating, perfect dharma of shuttos, merging of difference and unity to explore for the next few days. There's many ways this could go, and it probably will. And I think that Mike and I plan to alternate talks in morning and afternoon, and we'll just go through this this teaching. To start with, a little bit about this character who wrote this treatise, and a little historical context, how this fits into the vast array of Zen teachings. So this is the early birth of Zen or Chan in China. Now, many of these things might be really familiar to a lot of people, but maybe some people don't know about like these first six ancestors of Zen in China. So just briefly, we have Bodhidharma, who brought Zen from India to China in the 6th century. And at that time, historically, things were pretty clouded in the mists of unrecorded nowness. Bodhidharma is coming to China. By the time Sekitoki Sen, our author here, wrote this treatise, things were being recorded. So those seven generations before Shurto, not so clear historically. I mean, we have our Zen lineage, we chant their names. And there were probably people with these names that we sometimes recite, but when we go back as far as Bodhidharma, we don't really know what he was like or what was going on there exactly. Many legends grew up over time. So Bodhidharma is considered the first Chinese Zen ancestor, and then it was a very small movement. It wasn't called Zen yet. It was just this this teaching of directly pointing to the human heart and awakening to true nature, just being passed along through these generations, with the institution of Buddhism already thriving in China for centuries, but this was something new, this direct pointing. So it eventually got down to the person we call the fifth ancestor and the sixth ancestor, Huainong, whose platform sutra is a key text for early Chinese Zen. Platform sutra is attributed to Huainong, the sixth ancestor, but I think some of this discussion we'll get into today, because this merging of difference and unity is referring to some of the points of this Platform Sutra. It may not have really been written by the one we call the sixth ancestor. But that's our story of putting aside historical research into what was really happening at that time. This is our spiritual story, is that Huainong, the sixth ancestor, spoke the Platform Sutra, the teaching of immediacy. And then he had a disciple named Qingyuan, or in Japanese, Seigen Gyoshi. Not much is known about. The sixth ancestor had many, many students, and many ended up just being lost in obscurity and never really passing on the teaching. But the two students of his whose teaching continued on to the present day, were Seigen Gyoshi, which is the teacher of Sekitoki Sen, who wrote this Merging of Difference and Unity, and Nanyue, whose student was Matsu, one of the greatest Chinese Zen teachers. And so Matsu's lineage developed into, a few generations later, there was Linji, in Japanese Rinzai. So we have that Rinzai stream coming from that branch from the sixth ancestor, and then Seigen Gyoshi, Sekitoki Sen. A few generations later was Tozan Ryokai, Dongshan, which is the Soto Zen lineage. And in China, there's also five houses of Zen. Soto and Rinzai were the only ones that have come down to the present day, but the other three were also branched out from these two teachers. Maybe for our study, it's Sekitoki Sen and his contemporary Matsu, or Basso. So we don't have too much. There's a small record of Shirto's teaching. So Shirto is the Chinese way of saying Sekito in Japanese. Which is the author of this Sandokai, Merging of Difference and Unity. And Sekito is maybe easier to say than Shirto. But Shirto is kind of nice because that's how he was known in China. He lived from 700 to 790. And he was actually first practiced with the sixth ancestor, Hui Neng, till he was 13 years old. When he was 13, Hui Neng died. So apparently he was ordained as a novice priest with the sixth ancestor, but since he was only 13, he had to go practice with more teachers. And one story is that the Hui Neng actually told him, please go, after I die, please go practice with Ching Yuan Seigen, which he did. And we have his awakening story that I'll mention, because I think it's a strange story, but I think it's related to this merging of difference and unity. I think we can see how the way I hear it is, it's his insight with his teacher Seigen Gyoshi was played out later in writing this treatise. This is in the record of transmitting the light, the Denko Roku. So Shirto came to Ching Yuan, and Ching Yuan said, "Where are you from?" as they often begin these dialogues. And Shirto said, "I come from Cao Chi." That's the sixth ancestor's place, Cao Creek. And for those who don't know, this Cao is the in Japanese, so, it's the so of Soto. In Chinese, it's the Saodong lineage that has come down to us in this room today. The Sao, or the so, is from Saoxi, which is the name of the sixth ancestor. And later, there was another student of Tozan, the To of Soto, named Sozan, but he named himself, or he named his mountain after Saoqi in honor of the sixth ancestor. So some people say Soto Zen is Tozan and Sozan, his student, the combined names of those two. And some say no, actually, because Sozan is not really in our lineage, his his lineage didn't continue. So it's Tozan or Dongshan and the sixth ancestor, sometimes called Huineng, but sometimes called Shaoqi, because that was this place where he taught. And I like that story because I like the sixth ancestor. I like our name of Soto, deriving from the teachings of Huineng, the sixth ancestor, and Dongshan, and how their teachings wove together. So, Shuto says, I come from Shaoqi, because maybe Shaoqi or Huineng just had died, his teacher had died, and so now he's coming to practice with this other student of, you know, fellow student of the sixth ancestor, Qingyuan. I come from Shaoqi. So Qingyuan raised his whisk, his hosu, you know, the ceremonial whisk, and said, asked, does this exist at Shaoqi? You know, I've come from Shaoqi. Do they have this in Shaoqi? And this might be going a little bit out on a limb, but for today's talk, I propose that this, whether it's a whisk or a glass of water, is sandokai, is the merging of difference and unity. Do they have sandokai? This is before the sandokai is written, but do they have this merging of difference and unity at Shaoqi, where you came from? Or it could be, the meaning could also be, do they have this merging of difference and unity in the sixth ancestors' teaching? And Shuto answered, it's not only non-existent at Shaoqi, but it doesn't exist in India either. Feisty young guy. And this is, you know, this is his awakening story. He hasn't awakened yet, right? So he's, this could be seen as a little one-sided. A little bit like there's the unity side, but not the different side. They're not merged at this point. This, you know, we're referring to this in, you know, the form of a whisk or whatever. This doesn't exist at the sixth ancestors' place. It doesn't even exist in India. And if we're saying Shaoqi is the sixth ancestor, India is the Buddha's place, the Buddha's realm. There's nothing at my teacher's place, and there's nothing at the Buddha's place. And Qingyuan then asked, you haven't been to India yet, have you? Like, how would you know that? Or, you know, all these stories can be seen as all, you know, symbolic wordplay and kind of poetic discussions about, you know, if India represents the Buddha, the great sage of India, then you haven't been to Buddha's place, have you? And Shuto said, if I had been there, it would exist. It would exist. It doesn't even exist in India. Well, you haven't been to India, have you? Well, if I had been there, it would exist. In other words, like, I'm not going to say I've been any place and that anything's happening. And Qingyuan said, that's not good enough. Say more. And I see this as, you know, you're expressing the unity side very well, but do some more talking. Don't just cut off everything and say nothing exists, there's another half of the story here. There's the side of difference. That's not good enough. Say more. And Shirto said, Master, you should say half of it and not depend completely on me. It's a great dialogue, isn't it? And it's, I think it's wonderful too, because it just shows, this is, you know, in the 8th century China, that they were having these kind of discussions, that teachers and students were coming together and kind of sparring a little bit and kind of bantering a little and trying to work out, you know, get to the bottom of this through these kind of dialogues. So I also picture that young Shirto is actually a little bit intimidated here, and the teacher keeps pressing him, say more, and he's already like given some pretty good answers and saying, like, haven't I done enough? You say something. And Qingyuan says, I don't refuse to speak to you, but I'm afraid that after this, no one will be deeply awakened. Or, you know, if I let you off the hook here and say something for you, you won't have to work through this struggle and get to the bottom of it. And Shirto said, it's not that it will not exist. I think in this case, awakening, the previous sentence was, I don't refuse to speak to you, but I'm afraid that after this, no one will be deeply awakened. Shirto said, it's not that it will not exist. It's just that no one will be able to express it. Maybe referring to awakening in this case. It's not that there won't be awakening in the future if you say something. It's just that no one will be able to express it. So again, it's again this side of like, this ultimate cannot be expressed. It's still, Shirto still seems to be saying, well, there may be this awakening, but no one will be able to say anything about it except that it doesn't exist anywhere. And at this point, Qingyuan hits him with the whisk, and Shirto has great awakening. He breaks out of his one-sided view and merges with the feeling of a whisk hitting his forehead, and vast emptiness merged. This is one interpretation. So when we know a little bit more about Shirto, not much, but there's one of the few stories about his childhood is that in this village in China, people would do these animal sacrifices, like kind of some pre-Buddhist spirit religion, probably. Because I've never heard of animal sacrifices in China, but apparently there was such a thing going on in this village to appease the spirits or something. And Shirto, as a little boy, didn't like that, and he thought it was ridiculous. So he would, the cows that they would use for the sacrifice, that they would gather together a few days before, he'd always go and set them free and let them go wander off. So he was an animal rights activist. And apparently he did this many, many times, and the villagers were very upset with him because they couldn't do their sacrifices. So it could be that maybe Vanya is a reincarnation of of Shirto. Oh, well, another key thing here is that I think after he had practiced for a while with Qingyuan and He went off on his own. He built a hut on a top of a rock. And at that point, he got the nickname Sherto, which means sometimes translated stone head, but the head could be the kind of like the top of, so maybe more accurate to say like on top of the stone, because he always sat on top of the stone. Maybe a little nicer than stone head. So he's the on top of the stone. Shirto Shi Qian was his actual Dharma name, was Shi Qian, which means a rare transformation. Kisen, Sekito Kisen. So you might know Andy Ferguson leads these trips to China, Zen tours to China, and so I went on one with him, but we didn't go to Shirto's place, but later a friend of mine went. And he got this photo, which I'll pass around, of this is Shirto's stone in China. This is supposedly the actual stone that he sat on, and thus getting the nickname Shirto or Sekito. So this is the stone. They built a kind of monument on top with a little statue of Shirto on top. And this is his stupa, where his relics are enshrined. So Shirto is a real person, and this is his site in China. You can pass this around. So he got that name, and I think it was when he was sitting on the stone, maybe, or around that time period, he had this dream that leads up to this treatise. First he was reading this treatise of Song Chao, which was a pre-Zen Mahayana middle way kind of teaching. And when he came to where it said in the treatise, is it only the wise person who understands the myriad things as himself? He struck his desk and said, for the sage, there's no self. There's nothing that's not his true self. This is kind of like another little version of merging of difference and unity. Seems to me, for the sages, there's no self, there's just unity, and there's nothing that's not self. Could be different. True is in parentheses here, so it's kind of like really he's like, there's no self, and there's nothing that's not the self, is really what it says. The Dharma body is formless. Who can speak of self and others? The round mirror reflects clearly, and the wonderful forms of the myriad things appear in it spontaneously. Knowledge and its objects are not one or two. Who can say they come and go? How true these words of the treatise are. Maybe he said this out loud and somebody was recording it behind the screen or something. How did it get written down? He just said this to himself. So then he rolled up the scroll and fell asleep. And in a dream, he and the sixth ancestor were riding on a turtle, swimming around in a deep lake. When he awoke, he thought about the dream carefully. He interpreted the marvelous turtle to be wisdom and the lake to be the ocean of true nature, like emptiness. So like the wisdom riding along on emptiness. He and the sixth ancestor were riding on marvelous wisdom, swimming on the ocean of true nature. Later, he wrote the Song Tung Chi, or the San Do Kai, which is well known all over the world, even here. Maybe coming from that dream, or it seems they say they often mention it at the same time, like after this dream, he wrote this treatise called San Do Kai, or in Chinese, Sung Dong Qi, which is named after, supposedly, this Taoist treatise or poem. It's a treatise. from the Han Dynasty by the Taoist philosopher Wei Bo Yang. So the treatise itself doesn't really come from this, but the title, San Dokai, is the same title as this Taoist treatise. So, a little known fact in the Zen world. And this one person kind of researched this in some Chinese dictionary and looked into this, what this Taoist treatise was about. And the title, in the Chinese, is very... Chinese characters can be read in many different ways. And so it looks like that at least this one interpretation of this Taoist treatise was, according to this dictionary's interpretation of it, the San Dokai meant three things combined with the Great Way. Sounds very different than merging of difference and unity. But this character San, one of the meanings of San, besides just difference, is three. So it may be that in this early Taoist treatise it actually meant three, quite literally. Three things combined, and then this supposedly the three things that this treatise said merge in the way are the I Ching, the Taoist teachings of Lao Tzu and Chuang Tzu, and Taoist alchemy. So it seems like it has nothing to do really with the with Shirto's merging of difference and unity. And yet the some of the principles of the I Ching start to weave into early Chinese Chan at this point and into this Shirto's treatise. And Taoism, well, especially in the way that the Tao, the way, became usurped by Buddhism as a term to mean all of Buddha's teachings, the path, because literally the Tao means like the path or the way. So in Buddhism it became like the path of practice, the goal of practice, all kind of mixed together. Taoism and Zen in particular got all kind of mixed together in those early days. And just the very word Tao is one of the main ways they did. So the Buddha way, and in Shirto's treatise right at the beginning, it talks about the way, the Tao. So that was this old Taoist treatise. Now, San Dokai is generally interpreted now to mean the San, though it can mean three, can just mean like multiplicity or difference. So you can see how that derived from the meaning three, right? Just various things. It can also mean coming and going, multitude of appearances, difference, the side of multiplicity and difference, and phenomena. And the Do is kind of the opposite side. The means like sameness or equality, unity. And the Kai is like joining together or bond, agreement, union. So it's the difference and unity combined are those three characters, San, Do, Kai. So we have various translations in English, like the merging of difference and unity is a straightforward one. Another one is the harmony of difference and equality. Another one is the identity of relative and absolute. Another one that sounds quite different is the coincidence of opposites. The coincidence of opposites. And then we have another one that's maybe the most different. This is the Chinese teacher Shen Yan. His translation is inquiry into matching halves. And I think this is because this san, that can mean multiplicity, also can mean visiting or inquiry. San, we have this term San Zen. It's the same San as this term San Zen. So San Zen sometimes is like Dokusan, going to meet. It's meeting Zen. It's like going to meet a teacher and discussing Zen. And Dogen's use San Zen is, Dogen actually says San Zen is Zazen. So he kind of plays with this term. But inquiry, or we also have this term Henzan. I have a friend who told me that Koben Roshi was had some kind of strong feeling about this term, Zen term Henzan. It's the name of a Shobo Genzo fascicle. I don't know if people have heard him talk about this. This was Satya said that he spoke to Satya about this Henzan, meaning has this double meaning of visiting a complete inquiry or meeting. So it was a Zen term for like going on pilgrimage to meet different teachers. It was Henzan, but in Shobo Genzo Henzan, the fascicle, Dogen reinterprets it as thorough investigation into like this moment. Like you don't have to go anywhere or visit anyone to thoroughly investigate. But the san is the same as the san in Sandokai here, and can mean inquiry, but generally it's interpreted as difference or the myriad phenomena. Sandokai. So just to get into the text a little bit here, we can discuss it some. The mind of the great sage of India is intimately transmitted from west to east. The great sage of India is a poetic way of saying the Buddha. Intimately transmitted from west to east. And I think it's just a really neat coincidence, or not, but that the Dharma from its origination under the Bodhi tree in India started moving eastward. Right? It moved in all directions, actually, but we could say the kind of Zen aspect of Buddha's awakening started moving east to China, and then to Korea, and then to Japan, and then it like leaped over the ocean to California, and then it started moving east to Minnesota and New York and Europe and maybe eventually all the way back. Yeah, but isn't it interesting that it travels in this eastwardly direction up to us? the opposite way of the sun. The mind of the great sage of India is intimately transmitted from west to east. Intimate transmission. Mitsu is sometimes translated as secret. The Mikyo school is the Vajrayana school in Japan, like the esoteric school. So Mitsu is often translated as like esoteric or secret, but also intimate. And the various Zen commentaries on the Sandokai make it clear that this is not saying that the Buddha's teaching is secret. It's not at all secret. It's completely revealed, but it's very intimate. And transmitted, the character is not the usual character for transmission, but can mean entrust or give. Intimately given. This one says conveyed. Conveyed. communicated. communicated. So it is a character that actually appears on Dharma transmission documents for this kind of entrustment from teacher to student. So it's this intimately giving or entrusting or communicating from west to east, teacher to student, this mind of Sandokai, this mind that's the merged unity where nothing can be said, doesn't even exist in India, and a whisk hitting a mouth or a head. While human faculties are sharp or dull, the way has no northern or southern ancestors. So this seems to be a reference to this, you know, to Shirto's first teacher, the sixth ancestor, and the story we have. Try not to go into this too much. Probably many people have heard about the poetry contest with the sixth ancestor. It's a classic Zen story. The fifth ancestor says, "We're going to have this poetry contest, and the winner will become the sixth ancestor." Mm-hmm. Kind of like that. This is a very abbreviated now, right? And this one student of his writes this poem about polishing the mirror without going into all the details, because we could get into this if you want in discussion, but basically it's like, the mind is like a mirror and we should polish it to keep it clean all the time. And then Huineng, who's just an illiterate woodcutter, as the story goes, says, "Oh, that just doesn't seem quite right, that poem. It's written on a wall." He says, "I can't write, but can you let me write another poem here just for fun in response?" And it's something like, "There's no mirror, so there's no dust can land anywhere. So what would be the point of polishing?" That's not quite the poem, but that's the idea. And of course, the fifth ancestor says, that's more in accord with reality. So he became the sixth ancestor. So there's, but the beautiful thing about this, that difference there, is that we could see it as the as these two sides again. The polishing side of practice is like, try to stay with the breath, keep following the breath, make effort to be present, let go of thought again and again. You know, this is our, in a way we could say, gradual practice, right? We're making this effort to become more and more still and unified. It's one side of practice, and it's important. And then the other side is that there's no thing to be done. There's no stillness to reach that isn't already here. There's no Buddha mind to get to. It's already, everything is complete as it is. And that's the kind of, if we say the first is the gradual practice, that's the sudden side. Sudden's not quite right, because it's not like suddenly something happens. It's maybe more, I think imminent might be a nice word, or already the case, or immediately, like that. Instead of the sudden school, the school of immediacy, because it's like immediately there's nothing to be done. And practice has these two sides, and I think this is, as we sit Zazen through this week, we can remember that there's a side of making effort and really intentionally letting go of wandering mind and distraction, and there's this other side of like, where everything is perfectly complete to begin with. As Dogen says, that the way is originally perfect and all-pervading. How could it be contingent on practice and realization? It's, you know, despite ourselves. the way is originally perfect and complete. And in terms of merging of difference and unity, we could explore those two sides, the difference or the relative side, maybe especially if we speak of it in terms of relative and ultimate. The relative side is we're making effort and we're moving forward, we're progressing through practice, and the ultimate side is wherever we end up, it's the same place where we began in every single moment. There's nowhere to go. And it's not like that's better. It's sort of like the gradual approach gets a kind of bad rap in Zen. But I think there's a lot of value. We need to make effort, right? We need to raise a strong intention to practice. So the while human faculties are sharp or dull, the way has no northern or southern ancestors. So we have now referring to sudden and gradual, sharp and dull, and all this, the references in the Platform Sutra of the Sixth Ancestor. Actually, one of them is actually two different southern-northern references, I realized. Southern and northern, and there's two different, somewhat unconnected stories here, both in the Platform Sutra, which is actually called the title in this old translation is called the long full formal title of the Platform Sutra of the Six Ancestors, called the Southern School Sudden Doctrine, Supreme Mahayana, Great Perfection of Wisdom, Platform Sutra, preached by the Sixth Ancestor Wei Nung at Dafan Temple in Shaozhou. One roll. So it's the Southern School Sudden Doctrine Platform Sutra, Sudden Teaching, or the Southern School Immediacy Teaching, Mahayana, Great Perfect Wisdom Platform Sutra. So we have this, when the Sixth Ancestor first comes to the Fifth Ancestor as a young boy, he said, again, the Fifth Ancestor said, where are you from? The initial question. And just what is it that you're looking for from me, in this case? I replied, this is first person, he's telling the story. I replied, I am from Lingnan, which is down in the south, this barbarian country where, like, kind of more undeveloped, wild part of China, uncivilized, maybe we might say. I'm from Lingnan, a commoner from Xinzhou. I have come this long distance only to pay respects to you. I am seeking no particular thing, but only Buddha Dharma. The Master Fifth Ancestor then reproved me, saying, if you're from Lingnan, then you're just a barbarian. How can you become a Buddha? Maybe just testing him, or else he's really obnoxious. I replied, although people from south and people from north differ, there's no north or south in Buddha nature. Although my barbarian's body and your body are not the same, what difference is there in our Buddha nature? I think it's kind of nice that he doesn't like defend himself, like, how dare you call me a barbarian? He says, my barbarian's body and your body are different. So, while human faculties are sharp or dull, the way has no northern or southern ancestors. Could be referring to this, north or south has no Buddha nature. And then the Sixth Ancestor later says when teaching, good friends, in the Dharma there is no sudden or gradual, but among people some are keen and others dull. The dull recommend the gradual method. The keen or awakened practice the sudden teaching. So he gives it a bad rap there too. But I think the idea is that if you're completely awake, there's nowhere to go. There's no gradual thing to work on, actually. But when these two sides are completely integrated, there's both always. And I think, like in Shirto's awakening story, he's going to be falling into this there's nothing anywhere and there's nothing to do side. And, well, but say more. Express something. Speak something. And do something. Wei has no northern or southern ancestors. And then there's all kinds of things we could say, maybe not right now, about the, which the, if you're interested, the introduction of this translation of the Platform Sutra has this long story about this historical events that led to the southern and northern school. This is called the southern teaching. And the monk who lost the poetry contest went north and started the northern school of Zen. And there was seemed to be a lot of like political rivalry and some weird stuff going on in this time of early Zen between the southern and northern school. And so it may be that the Platform Sutra actually was written according to this author's historical research. It was not even written by the sixth ancestor. It was written by a later student of his, and there were various stories put in to promote the southern school. And a lot of political stuff woven in here, and a lot about lineage and ancestry and defending legitimacy in the early days of Zen. They kind of ended up working that stuff out in the end, or it naturally just evolved. And the northern school eventually did actually just die out. So all the Zen that we have now is southern school immediacy teaching derived from the sixth ancestor. But it could be that controversy, which was seemed like kind of a big thing at this time, is also what Shirto is referring to here in a very nice way. He's kind of like, while human faculties are sharp or dull, the Wei has no northern or southern ancestors. So it's not a matter, like, you guys stop fighting about this stuff. It's not a matter of this school or that school. The Wei doesn't discriminate like that. And I think it's interesting that, you know, the southern part of China was the barbarian land that in the early part, Huainan was getting criticized for being a southerner, but then the southern school was the one that got promoted in the end as like the more awakened, immediate teaching, which is kind of nice that they're kind of reversed. So north has some benefits, south has some benefits. And but the Wei doesn't discriminate like that. So there's some introduction to the beginning of this text and the context in which it arose. Any comments or questions or things to bring up about this? Yes.
When you read the about the sixth patriarch, is the patriarch the same as the ancestor?
Yeah. Just different ways of translating that character. So I think in early American Zen, it usually got translated as patriarch, and then women and men started saying, well, what's this with this patriarchal thing? And you know, it's interesting, looking in the Chinese and Japanese dictionaries, I almost never have seen patriarch as a translation. So it's that character is definitely not connected with maleness over femaleness. And it does mean ancestor, and it's used for ancestors in other contexts outside of Zen. So at least like San Francisco Zen Center tradition, we always say ancestor now to be more gender neutral. Patriarch. And we say Buddhas and ancestors. It's like because there's this, they're our family. I think patriarch doesn't necessarily have this family feeling either. I like the word ancestor because there are spiritual ancestors actually. Our, you know, in a way, blood ancestors in our Zen blood lineage, going all the way back to the sixth ancestor in Shirto. In response to you say something, if I say something, or like if I take it as if I help you out here, if I say something in the future, awakening will die out or no one will be awakened.
He's not saying it's specific to that you are no one.
I don't refuse to speak to you, but I'm afraid that after this, no one will be deeply awakened. That would be another interpretation, is that actually there's no one to be awakened anyway, right? Is that what you meant?
Yes.
Yeah, that there's no person to be awakened. I don't refuse to speak to you, but I'm afraid that after this, no one will be deeply awakened. And then his reply is, it's not that it will not exist, it's just that no one will be able to express it. Yeah, so that does fit together there. But why would he say, but? I don't refuse to speak, but I'm afraid that after this, no one will be awakened. In fact, he does speak by just saying that sentence too, right? Well, we can look a little bit what, if we have that part here, by Kazon's commentary here. So he says, commenting on, Master, you should say half of it and not depend completely on me. Kazon, who's a couple of generations after Dogen, writing this. Meeting in this way and speaking in this way, if each just communicates a half, how can the whole thing be expressed? Even if heaven and earth collapsed and the entirety was revealed alone, this would still be going halfway, which is an interesting point about this half, kind of implying that each person has to express completely. It's not kind of like making a deal, like you do half and I'll do half and that'll be complete. It's like each person is complete, has to completely express, and that meeting covers everything. This place is still not reached by oneself, not borrowing someone else's resources. How much less can you inform someone else by continuing to go halfway when you're trying to communicate intimate words and absolutely not depend on someone else? On the contrary, you can only experience fundamental true self alone. Therefore, Qinglan said, I don't refuse to speak to you, but I'm afraid that after this, no one will be deeply awakened. So it could be seen either way, I think, without commentary, that that it's not a matter of you or I, but also if I help you out too much here, this is how I was seeing it, if I give you too much here, you won't be able to fully reveal yourself. And then Kazon says, even if someone speaks of pain or speaks of bitterness, if that person doesn't experience pain deep in his bones or experience bitterness ripping apart his tongue, he ultimately cannot understand the reality of it. You cannot get it through words. So that's another take here. I don't refuse to speak to you, but I'm afraid that after this, no one will be awakened. If I say anything, because you want me to say something else to fully reveal this, and you're expecting my words to complete you, it's not going to work that way. That's a kind of a third interpretation. Because this is the way it is, spiritual teachers do not use words indiscriminately or do things pointlessly, thus protecting the principle of self-effort. That's in parentheses there, so that might be Francis Cook's interpretation. Letting people struggle and work it out on their own. Uh, as usual, koans are very wide and open and can be entered from all different sides. Do we have some sense of in Zazen, these two, just as presented in the polishing story, that we're making this effort, and I think particularly if we start to feel like we're really struggling, this is just a little Zazen encouragement as we continue to sit. If we feel like we're making a lot of effort and getting nowhere, and feeling totally drowsy, totally distracted, or whatever, can't settle in. Just to remember this other side, maybe not some deep realization, but just take up and open to this other side of that nothing actually needs to be done. Like our struggle in itself is just a perfect manifestation of Sandokai. It's not like, well, this is just useless, I might as well just give up because this is not going anywhere. To just, in the back of our mind, just remember, like, this is not going anywhere, but there's nowhere to go. I think this is just great medicine for Sashin, both these sides. We can fall into that one too, of like, just kind of really relaxed, but, maybe too relaxed, kind of just sitting here. I'm kind of like, I'm not that concentrated, but I'm not that disturbed. Just kind of like, there's a little daydream going on, but I know it's kind of empty and like that. That's maybe when like, okay, no, now let's bring up like the great intention side. It's like really return to this moment. Do some gradual practice. Yes. Yes, and this theme will be woven all through this treatise about these two sides. So let's definitely keep this in mind, the part about the relationship between them. What exactly is that? Let's keep it when we start talking about light and dark and all. And I think you're right that merging almost sounds like they're kind of get all murky and mixed together in some metaphysical way or something, but harmony has a different feeling than merging, I think, and maybe that's why that translation was changed in some places from merging to harmony, because harmony could mean like they're not actually mixed together, but they're in harmony, they're separate, like two different people singing in two different pitches or however musical harmony works, right? It's like they're actually different notes, but they're in harmony, like they work together, but they don't get all blended up. A lot of the treatise talks about each keeps its own place, things like that. Yeah. So yeah, each thing on its own, but it actually includes the other in a way. Each thing being totally separate, but in harmony. And yeah, all about the relationship between those. Let's keep exploring. Yeah.
Well, the translation is not about a different category of knowing, in my view.
Mm-hmm. Coincidence of general and specific. Specific is another possible title. Coincidence of dogs and dogness. Yes. Dog and dog nature. I think Suzuki Roshi had a translation of something like the oneness of one and many. Just kind of playing with a little bit. And I think he also talks about that Kai, I think Suzuki Roshi says, is like a handshake. So that's another image. Literally means a handshake. Mm-hmm. A agreement or bond or union, agreement of difference and unity. So especially when we're talking, if we're getting into the relative truth and ultimate truth, what's the relationship between those? I think that's an important topic for all of Mahayana Buddhism. That's one way to look at this whole treatise of the two truths, very, very important teaching. And also later, Dungshan will pick up on this. The Jewel Mirror Samadhi, a few generations later, written by Dungshan, is kind of a commentary on this Sandokai, but it just gets much more elaborate, and it takes this light and dark and these opposites, but it not only mixes them together, looks at one relationship between them, it looks at these five different relationships between the light and the dark, or the ultimate and the relative, called the five positions or five ranks. So it's a lot about relationship between what you know, clarifying what is this relationship, first clarifying what we mean by ultimate and conventional, or these different terms, and then even more difficult, I think, looking at what is that relationship between them in terms of practice and life. So time is rolling on in the world of San. In the world of Do, we haven't even started. It's already done. It hasn't started and it's already done. And but for some kind of harmonious merging here, let's stop this talk and have some more Kinin and Zazen. And we can, we have those four vows. We can, let's just chant them once through. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way.